May it please the court. My name is Randy Miller, and I represent the appellants, All American Pet Protein, Craig Broughton, and John Landers. Although there is no covenant not to compete at issue, and the players in the industry are well known to the public, PPH moved the court for a preliminary injunction, not only preventing the misappropriation of trade secrets, but also preventing business with many of the industry players. The court granted that preliminary injunction. We believe it was an error for three reasons. First, the scope of the injunction exceeded any protection for the misappropriation or perceived or threatened misappropriation of trade secrets. Second, there was no showing of irreparable harm. Rather, the court found that misappropriation standing alone was sufficient for a preliminary injunction. And third, that the bond was insufficient. I'd like to move to the second argument dealing with irreparable harm. Colorado has a well-standing policy that no preliminary injunction may be granted where money damages can be calculated and compensate that harm. That is in Rule 65, and it is well established in case law. Most notably, it was applied to trade secret cases in Bishop v. Cuomo. And in that, the court said that irreparable harm, quoting other cases, was perhaps the single most important prerequisite for the issuance of preliminary injunction. And in that, they affirmed the court's denial of a preliminary injunction on the grounds that once there was an agreement not to share or use the trade secrets, prohibiting competition with other customers was too far. Here, there is no irreparable harm. The record makes clear that we are talking about lost contracts, revenue.
Mr. Miller, let me ask a couple of lead-in questions to this issue of irreparable harm. First, would you agree that the trial court could have based an injunction on the Jet Courier and Coombs against Rosner cases in this matter?
I do not think so, Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly.
Well, it goes to this. I think the law is pretty well settled in Colorado that employees who plan to compete with their employer before they leave have breached their fiduciary obligations to the employer. And so I'm asking you, in this case, isn't it true that the employees here not only plan to compete, but in fact contacted customers, just exactly like the Coombs against Rosner case, before they left the employment?
I think I would respond to saying the law under Jet Courier and the law of of Colorado is that employees are free to prepare to compete. And in the Walk Concrete Pumping case, for example, they found that preparing to compete, even if you don't tell your employer, falls into the realm of preparing to compete with this, which is permissible.
Well, in the Coombs against Rosner case, as I recall the facts, employees were real estate brokers. And they looked in the records and found when the listing contracts were to expire, called those customers, and arranged to have a listing agreement with them once they left employment. The case is pretty clear that that's a breach of fiduciary responsibility. And in this case, as I understand the facts, these employees contacted customers. And that leads me to the irreparable harm. Isn't it an irreparable harm to the employer to lose a prospective business opportunity with existing customers?
I would answer your question in threefold, Your Honor. First of all, the court made an express finding, and I will answer the court's question, express finding that it was not making any ruling concerning the duty of loyalty. And that was in the verdict.
I understand.
Okay. Second, Your Honor, I think the important distinction in the court's example in the case law was solicitation of clients. There is no evidence in the record, and the court made no findings. There was any solicitation in this case. In fact, the court was only making its finding about trade secrets after the departure. The second one is that in the absence of solicitation, there would be no right to enjoin that activity. And that again falls under the Bishop v. Cuomo standard. In particular here, there was also some discussion that perhaps calling to suppliers may limit the supply, but PPH's representative John Zabel testified in that was no shortage of supply. It simply was a higher price that they would have to pay. So even in that case, there are no irreparable damages that cannot be redressed by a jury verdict with damages.
Well, Mr. Miller, let me ask you, this is the trial court also found that defendants had harmed plaintiff by taking the suppliers, which would create an inability to meet contractual obligations. And so would that be something beyond mere monetary damages?
It would not, Your Honor, because Mr. Zabel testified in, excuse me, Your Honor, at page 194, at line 8, they could always go get more supply. It would simply be more expensive. Again, something that you could measure with damages and after a full trial could assess those as economic damages.
Well, let me ask you a little follow-up to that, though. Well, wouldn't it be more of a, I guess, a reputation loss or goodwill loss, in fact, if you aren't able to meet your obligations with your customers?
I would say that there's no evidence in the record, and there's nothing, in fact, the record is the other direction, that those facts were not present here. If, in fact, somebody had made a showing and, for example, there was no dispute on the return and non-use of any sort of trade secret information. That was always agreed upon. I suppose if there was a set of facts, which is not before us, indeed, where that reputation relief could be fashioned in a narrowly tailored way in accordance with the guiding law in Colorado, where you could narrowly tailor that, which would go to my scope argument, Your Honor.
Okay.
But certainly you could protect that. In the court's written order, the court said that the act of misappropriation standing alone entitled plaintiff to injunctive relief. And in that, the court cited Sunoco Products v. Johnson. I believe that was an error as well. Sunoco Products did not deal with Rule 65. It did not deal with preliminary injunction. And as a result, the concept of irreparable harm was not before that court. If anything, the court in Sunoco Products found that damages after the fact for trade secrets, even if misappropriated, could be measured and quantified by money damages. The cases cited by PPH often deal with either a covenant not to compete, which is not present here, or it involves the simple prohibition on the use or misappropriation of trade secrets, which, as I said, is not in dispute. It's simply whether more broad competition is overly broad in the order. Let me turn to that argument, if I may, Your Honors. The injunction exceeds the scope of the Colorado Uniform Trade Secrets Act and Rule 65. It's well established under Bishop v. Cuomo and Altmel that any relief on a motion for a preliminary injunction, because of its nature, must be sparingly and cautiously applied and only to the extent necessary. In Bishop v. Cuomo, outlined that it must reasonably prevent actual or threatened misappropriation. And in that case, this court affirmed the denial of the preliminary injunction, which allowed a prohibition on the misappropriation of trade secrets, but allowed competition more broadly, knowing that it could be redressed at trial if, in fact, it was found to be misappropriation. Here it's notable that the court's order prohibits business not only, excuse me, Your Honor, the court's ruling was founded on the idea of trade secrets reflected in what was marked as Exhibit 4 in the record. The court made that filing at line 507, line 13. And in that, it's found that although the temptation to expand that definition was tempting, it was going to refuse that and not find any trade secrets beyond what was on Exhibit 4. Notably, we believe the order exceeds lawful bounds because it prohibits business with 19 entities.
Mr. Miller, excuse me, at least in the oral findings, did not the court address some exhibits other than the Exhibit 4 as trade secrets?
Yes, Your Honor, the court did address it, but at page 507.13, it expressly said that it was limiting its findings to those reflected on Exhibit 4. And in particular, there's been some argument regarding the some communications before they departed. The court went further to say that it was expressly not ruling with the duties of loyalty. Here, the order exceeds its bounds because it prohibits business beyond the what is necessary to protect misappropriation. Number two, it prohibits any sort of competition with businesses, even those who are not on Exhibit 4. And number three, there is no exception for legitimate business. For example, if the customers or suppliers approached All American or provided the information. And in that regard, the court itself reflected on page 516, it seems to me that if there is information that they did obtain exclusive of Exhibit 4 and consistent with the other case law that allows someone to use their knowledge and experience in the business to compete, then it would be error for me to preclude them from using that going forward, even on a preliminary basis. When the final order came out, there was no such exception. We agree with the court's initial statement and believe that the court is speaking about Phoenix Capital v. Dowell and a number of other cases that held that where the evidence could come in from a proper place, it would be improper to prevent that use. We addressed the particular information on page 7 of our opening brief. Based on that, we believe that the court did commit error in applying any of those. I would also identify that the cases relied upon by PPH are not applicable. In Xantrax, it involved a statement that the defendant, who was not subject to a covenant not to compete, was, and I quote it at star 16, free to enter the marketplace without the use of Xantrax trade secrets. That is the relief we're looking for here. Now, in Xantrax, there was an employee that had a non-compete, and the prohibition of that would be proper. But those are not the case. That is not the facts here. And in SBM versus Garnett, again, there the court was simply preventing the misappropriation of trade secrets, and it made an express finding that in that case, the use of trade secrets would cause irreparable harm. Here we are saying the broad competition and interaction would be too broad, and it is not supported by any of the cases. Your Honors, I would love to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Miller.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Sayers. Virginia State Bar registration number is 23066, and I'm admitted pro hoc vice. I represent the appellee, Premium Pet Health, LLC. I'd like to start my argument by just addressing two matters that were raised by the court to Mr. Miller. One question was there any evidence of or any finding of actual solicitation? Mr. Miller said that there was not, but there is. If the court looks at record page 0683, the June the 17th, 2014 order denying the motion for a stay of the preliminary injunction says the following. There is a reasonable probability of success on the merits because, quote, there is evidence in the record to suggest that defendants used plaintiff's confidential information to contact plaintiff's suppliers and customers and to solicit plaintiff's business from them. And in paragraph 16, Your Honors, of the preliminary injunction order of May the 30th, the following statement is made, this finding. The defendants claim that they did not use PPH's confidential information, but, quote, the credible and persuasive evidence in the record leads the court to conclude otherwise. And that's an interesting tonal note, if I may say so, because the defendants postured this case as a case involving credibility and honesty. And that addresses the second point, the opening point that I wanted to make, where Your Honor, Judge Lichtenstein raised the question, was there any reputational issue here? And there was. The defendant's own evidence confirms the importance of credibility and honesty. PPH lost four contracts immediately. That represented the premium part of its production capability. The bison, the duck products, the quail products, 95 to 100% were lost the loss of those actually has a ripple effect over PPH's business, because it's not just those pure products. Those products are also included in blends of other products. And that affects, the loss of the supplies there affects PPH's ability to fulfill its contractual obligations to its customers. Now, what's the effect of that? I'm going to use the defendant's own words. Mr. Landers stated, this is a closely knit industry where your word is everything. And then he explained in paragraph 44 of his affidavit, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 21, in this business, you don't get a second chance with suppliers or customers. If you can't follow through on your promises, you're done, because you're only as good as your word. And that's exactly right. That's exactly what this this case was about. The whole purpose of preliminary injunctive relief, Your Honor, is to prevent a tort or wrong and to preserve the status quo until a final hearing and determination of the controverted rights of the parties can be made. And that's exactly what the preliminary injunction did and is doing in this case. It's preventing harm. And I would strongly suggest to the court that here you have a district judge who carefully, meticulously, intelligently, and articulately went through each of the six factors required by the leading case, Rathke versus McFarlane, and concentrated properly on the two most important factors. One is obviously probability of success on the merits, and I'll turn to that immediately, and the second is irreparable harm. The district court found that the credible evidence in this record unquestionably established a real and immediate threat of imminent future injury to PPH. That's page 513 of the court's findings on May the 28th. And under those circumstances, where there is irreparable harm, as there was here, and the other factors, each of which was addressed specifically by Chief Judge Martinez, and he made specific findings as to each one of these factors, just exactly as he should have done. Section 7-74-103 of the Colorado Code provides that temporary and final injunctions, including affirmative acts, may be granted on such equitable terms as the court deems reasonable to prevent or restrain an actual or threatened misappropriation of trade secrets, and both existed here. The district court was actually struck by the lack of candor exercised by the defendants in this case. They both filed affidavits saying, we didn't take any confidential information with us, we didn't use any confidential information. The court actually addressed that when they testified at the hearing that they actually did have PPH's confidential information still. Plaintiff's Exhibit 4 is, as the district court said, extremely detailed, extensive in scope, and Mr. Broughton actually had that in his possession at all times, up to and including the date of the hearing. And there's no question that that confidential information, which gave the defendants an inside track as to the price structure, the purchasing history, the pricing product by product, it's confidential information of the most detailed variety. They used this information to solicit customers and suppliers of PPH, and the evidence quite clearly established that at the preliminary injunction hearing. In fact, Your Honor, Judge Boris, you say, well, didn't the district judge actually have other information before him other than Plaintiff's Exhibit 4? Well, he did. We would draw the court's attention to Plaintiff's Exhibit 3, because there are two things involved in this case. There's evidence of what was actually misappropriated, that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 4, and that was actually, it's the PPH master month by month, and that was actually listed as one of the documents that had been downloaded by Mr. Broughton to an external device and then removed. We actually were able to recreate that through the services of a forensic accountant, a technology person, Dr. Donna Eno, and she actually testified at the hearing that that document had been downloaded. Attempts had been made to delete or hide the fact that it had been downloaded, and she was able to recreate that. But Plaintiff's Exhibit 3 contains a wealth of other information concerning information downloaded by Mr. Broughton to external devices and successfully deleted. I'll give you a couple of examples. On page 12, for example, of Plaintiff's Exhibit 3, quote, customer supply information. When was that last accessed? February the 13th, 2014, 2 weeks before Mr. Broughton left. Page 22, customer supply information. Last accessed, same day, February the 14th, 2014. Page 23, inbound waits by week, last accessed, same date, February the 14th. There were also inbound waits by week projected for the new company called NewCo, AAPP. There were also downloads for AAPP made from Mr. Broughton's PPH computer to external devices. So quite clearly, he was projecting the amount of product that AAPP was going to be selling weeks before he actually resigned.
Is it correct that the trial court only branded Exhibit 4 as a trade secret and not the other exhibits?
The answer to that question, Judge Boris, is absolutely. That's the only document that we were able to actually to retrieve. The court may be aware that this case has been placed on the civil access pilot project, and it's been set for an expedited trial on May the 4th of next year. We have immediately engaged in discovery, and when this case goes back down to the district court, this court can be sure we're going to be asking for an expansion of the injunction, not a contraction, because we found multiple other examples of confidential information downloaded. But the point I'm making to the court is, because the defendants, the appellants' efforts were successful in deleting the information that they'd actually downloaded, we didn't actually have any such information at the preliminary injunction hearing other than the one that we were able to retrieve, which was Plaintiff's Exhibit 4.
Well, Mr. Sayers, I'm not sure I understood the answer then. So do you agree that the court only relied on Exhibit 4 as actually containing the trade secrets that was the subject of this injunction?
I think the answer to that question, Your Honor, is yes. The only actual trade secret document that was available at the preliminary injunction hearing was Exhibit 4. But the district court was well aware that multiple other confidential information had been downloaded, and the defendants have successfully covered their tracks by deleting that information, and thus we weren't able to recreate what they'd actually downloaded.
Okay.
But, and so you are also relying, I take it, on the threatened misappropriation as well as the actual misappropriation as support for the injunction?
Yes, absolutely. In terms of the overbreadth, I'd like to address that that point, if I may. The injunction was not in the least overbroad. The defendant's own evidence, exhibits B and C, I believe, showed that there were potentially many hundreds of suppliers. In fact, Exhibit B was a list of potential suppliers and customers, which was 749 pages long, and the defendants introduced just a few of those pages, but they attest to the fact that there are many, many suppliers and customers. And the preliminary injunction here didn't put AAPP out of business. It didn't prevent AAPP from doing business with the vast majority of those suppliers and customers. It was absolutely limited to a small number of suppliers and customers that were directly linked to improper solicitation prior to the resignations in this case. For example, taking each of the entities that was not listed on Exhibit 4, Cargill, Hormel, JBS Swift, Mountain States Rosen, Rocky Mountain Lamb, Hill's Pet Nutrition, and Mars Pet Care. What is the evidence with respect to that? The evidence comes from the defendant's own mouths, not from evidence put on by PPH. There's no way that the defendants could have locked up these customers without knowing PPH's confidential information about its prices, quantities, orders, delivery history, and they would have the inside track to be able to line these customers up and lock them up by giving them better prices than PPH was offering them. The district court made a reasonable inference based upon substantial evidence in the record that confidential information had been used, as I said at the beginning of the argument, to solicit and line up these customers and suppliers pre-resignation. These names were not spirited up by PPH. They came from the February the 18th, 2014 application to the Greeley Planning Commission that was submitted under oath by the defendants, where JBS Swift, Mountain States Rosen, Hills, and Mars were identified as already having been locked up. So that's what the defendants were telling the Greeley Planning Commission under oath before they resigned on February the 18th. With respect to the other three, Cargill, Hormel, and Rocky Mountain, the other three that are actually not listed on Plaintiff's Exhibit 4, the evidence regarding improper solicitation and locking up those customers comes from the mouth of Mr. Broughton. There's pages 75 and 76 of the trial testimony of Sean I hope I got his name right, Balthaser, B-A-L-T-H-A-S-E-R, who was the director of business operations. Mr. Broughton told him on the day of his resignation, we've already locked up the two main customers of PPH, Diversified and Diamond. But Cargill, Hormel, and Rocky Mountain were stated by Mr. Broughton to Mr. Zabel at PPH weeks before he resigned as having already been locked up. So the district court had evidence of actual solicitation, and it was then faced with the problem of framing an appropriate order. That problem has been noted in the Prybill case that was cited in the briefs. The court there emphasized that when in fashioning an appropriate preliminary injunction order in a trade secrets case, a court faces particular difficulties. And the court there stated that no opportunities for loopholes should be allowed. It's a direct quote from the Seventh Circuit. And the more specific an order is, the more opportunities for evasion there are, especially where there's been deceptive conduct. And so the court here, faced with the deceptive conduct on the part of the appellants, was very concerned that they shouldn't be permitted to do through the back door what they couldn't do through the front door. Now, as I've said, the defendant's own evidence establishes that there were a multitude of suppliers and customers. So how did the trial court confine the scope of this order to the 19 entities? I've explained with respect to 12 of them, they're listed on Plaintiff's Exhibit 4. The other seven are linked directly by the evidence under oath submitted by the defendants to the Greeley Planning Commission or admissions made by Mr. Broughton to Messrs. Zabel and Balthaser. But here's what the court said. The court specifically tailored the injunction in an equitable way, and I'm quoting from page 0684 of the record, in an equitable way that enjoined the defendants from contracting or doing business with a small number of suppliers and customers. And that's exactly what it was. It was as narrow as could be, and as narrow as it should be, and as I said, it's been effective, and it continues to be effective.
Well, Mr. Sayers, let me just ask you this. There are two portions in this order which restrains conduct, which includes but is not limited to. So that but not limited to language, can you explain to me how that does describe in reasonable detail the acts to be restrained?
The court was actually imposing restrictions on the ability to compete. And basically the court was saying, you can't compete directly, you can't compete indirectly. You can't try to circumvent this order through third parties or straw men. Now, I see that my time is up, Your Honor. I might just wind up in 10 seconds.
Please complete your thought.
The district court in this case prepared a carefully and narrowly crafted injunction to include a limited number of suppliers and customers that the evidence had established had been improperly solicited as a result of a head start given to Mr. Broughton and Mr. Landers by their misappropriation and deliberate misappropriation of PPH's highly confidential trade secret information. The injunction preserved the status quo. That's exactly what it was supposed to do. The district court's decision was correct, and the district judge in this case faithfully and diligently followed Rafke and each of the factors that he was required. The decision was correct, and that decision should be affirmed. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sayers. Mr. Miller, you have 2 minutes and 21 seconds, and I'm going to give you an additional 10 seconds as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Starting with Judge Lichtenstein's question, the order prohibited not just business, but any business in an unclear term, directly or indirectly. It also prohibited business not only with some of these large players, but with any entities they do business with. And it bears repeating to the final point that this was a small slice. This was not a small slice. This involves Hill's Science Diet, Nestle Purina, Mars Pet Care, Natura, Cargill, Hormel, JBS Swift. These are not small players. These are large players. And being able to do business directly or indirectly, even if it has nothing to do with misappropriation of trade secrets, is a step too far. For example, they could hire an outside vendor, say, we don't want to know where, when, or how you obtain this. I just want to sell it to you. That would be compliant. Also, there's no way to know who JBS Swift is using for their trucking. Who are they using for their air conditioning? And while it may be a rule of reason, it's not clear based on this order what the limitations are. I want to turn also to irreparable harm and be clear that when the court was entering its order on page of the verdict, page 512, the court said, time was in Colorado that there was ample case law that said you couldn't get an injunction if there was just money damages at issue. We've evolved as a society since then, and greater recognition has been given to the fact that the business is important in our society and community. I would proffer that the requirement that if money damages can in fact compensate the damages is still the law in the state of Colorado, and there still must be a showing of irreparable harm, which is defined as harm that cannot be redressed by money damages. Second, as to scope, there is an ability to prevent the threatened or the misappropriation or threatened misappropriation of trade secrets, and that would be done in the way it was done in Zantex and the other cases, prohibiting the misappropriation or threatened misappropriation by the use of those trade secrets in any way, shape, or form. I see my time is out. I would move here that the court's order exceeds the bounds for the state of Colorado. It is overly broad in its scope and ambiguous in the ability for a party to try and comply in good faith with this order. It is also not founded by irreparable harm, and the issue should be addressed after a full trial to the jury where they can make the assessment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Thank you again, Mr. Sayers. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent arguments this morning. They were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.
Thank you. Thank you.